You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Boisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out what female leaders have to say about why there aren't more women CEOs.
First, it was just over a week ago that Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn announced plans to invest billions of dollars in Wisconsin, building a plant here that officials say will employ thousands of workers. The company initially said that the investment would be $10 billion, but President Trump says Foxconn CEO Terry Guo told him privately it could be much higher.
So he told me off the record he thinks he may go $30 billion. Think of this. He may go $30 billion investment, but he told me that off the record, so I promised I wouldn't tell anybody.
Meanwhile, back at home, state lawmakers have been cheering Foxconn's decision to come to Wisconsin. However, Republican lawmakers are split over how to move forward with a plan that would send $3 billion in economic incentives to the company amid the backdrop of a state budget that has yet to be passed. Plus, we're also hearing rumblings today about a possible second Foxconn facility in Wisconsin.
Laurel White joins us now with an update on the latest Foxconn news. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
In a recent story, you wrote that lawmakers are clashing over whether to prioritize the stalled state budget or the legislation needed to formally close the agreement with Foxconn. What's going on there?
That's right. So we had that complication sort of arise on Tuesday. The Assembly GOP had a press conference in the afternoon outlining their plans for moving ahead with the Foxconn deal. Their Assembly public hearing is actually happening right now. It started at 1:30 this afternoon, so they're certainly rolling on this Foxconn deal. The steps in the process are to have the public hearing, then the committee vote, and then go to the floor vote in the Assembly. So we got that outline from them on Tuesday early afternoon. And then shortly after, reporters went to hear what was going on with the Senate and what Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald had planned as far as the Senate timeline for the incentive package. And when he emerged from a Senate Republican caucus, reporters asked him, "So, what's your plan for the Foxconn deal?" And he said, "Oh, well, we were talking about the state budget." So he made it pretty clear in that line of questioning that the Senate's priority is to get the state budget finished. The state budget, some folks might recall, the official deadline for that was June 30th. So we're about a month past that deadline. And Senator Fitzgerald says the Senate's perspective is get that state budget done, and then we can move along and address the Foxconn deal in the Senate.
So the Assembly is working actively on Foxconn. The Senate is saying the budget needs to take priority. Where is Governor Walker on this?
Well, Governor Walker yesterday said he thinks that the state legislature can, quote, walk and chew gum at the same time. So he wants the state budget and the Foxconn deal to advance as concurrently as possible. He wants them to be worked on at the same time and hopefully approved fairly quickly.
We're talking with Laurel White. She's WPR's state capitol reporter, and we're looking at the current situation with the Foxconn incentive bill and the state budget and other goings on up at the Capitol. And Laurel, you know, here's the Foxconn deal, which has a huge price tag for it from the state with, you know, projected big gains. We're also trying to get a decision and agreement on the budget. How much do those two things interact, or how closely tied are they?
Well, that's something that Democrats in particular have voiced some concern about. They've said, we really don't know the impact of this Foxconn incentive package on the budget that we're currently negotiating. And actually, that was something that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said on Tuesday as well. He said, you know, my Senate Republican caucus has a lot of questions about how the Foxconn deal is going to affect the budget, when some of these tax incentives and other financial incentives are going to be paid out. And so, there's a lot of unanswered questions there. One of the ways that it does sort of obviously overlap that we can talk about right now is a transportation element. So part of the Foxconn incentive package includes about $250 million in bonding to do some highway work on 9094 in southeast Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So the transportation budget is obviously a big part of the incomplete state budget right now. There's been a lot of conflict over bonding and projects for transportation. So the fact that there's some bonding there and there's some project outline in the Foxconn deal provides a little bit of obvious overlap with the state budget, but otherwise we don't know what some of those other big overlaps might be and some of the implications of the Foxconn deal.
Is there a deadline by which the legislature has to pass and the governor has to sign this Foxconn deal? Are we potentially bumping up against a date coming up?
Well, what we've heard so far in the hearing this afternoon from the CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which is the state's economic development arm, and the secretary of the Department of Administration, is that Foxconn is, quote, ready to go, that they want to start hiring folks, they want to start moving right now. But of course, they can't do that until the legislature approves the incentive package. So there's a sense that, you know, proponents of this package want to move pretty quickly. But it's not my understanding that there is a specific deadline that they're working up against right now.
You pointed out in a recent piece that some labor groups are speaking out on the Foxconn deal. What are their concerns?
Well, it is interesting. We've had some high-profile groups indeed come out against the Foxconn deal. We actually, just this afternoon, had conservative group Americans for Prosperity come out against the Foxconn deal, which is sort of an interesting element that might affect some of the conservative proponents of this deal because they are such an influential group. They're generally not in favor of tax incentive packages. They want to lure businesses to the state without, you know, having financial incentives. So we have had obviously some pretty big players weighing in on this deal, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of influence they have as lawmakers continue to debate, public hearings continue to be held, and we eventually get to some floor discussions on this incentive package.
And I want to go back to what President Trump said earlier this week, suggesting that the Foxconn CEO told him privately that the investment might actually be more like $30 billion instead of the $10 billion that was previously announced. Do we know what that claim might involve?
Well, you know, reporters have asked Governor Walker about that pretty consistently. Obviously, there's a lot of interest about potential second locations for Foxconn in Wisconsin. We know that the areas in southeast Wisconsin are the focus right now, but there has been that recent reporting that a Madison location might be in the works potentially. But when asked about this, Governor Walker says everything about sites, site selection, number of sites is all speculation right now because we're still pretty early in the process. So that's something that we're just going to have to wait and see about, I think.
Laurel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about the latest news about Foxconn and the deal that looks to bring the company to Wisconsin. Women still aren't making it all the way to the top positions in corporate America. Among Fortune 500 companies, only 6% have CEOs who are women. The slow progress of women to the upper echelons of leadership raises questions our next guest tried to answer. She asked women who almost made it what happened.
Susan Chira joins us now. She's a senior correspondent on gender issues for the New York Times, where she just wrote the piece, Why Women Aren't CEOs. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Susan, in your piece, you talked with 24 CEOs, you talked with would-be chief executives, headhunters, deans of business schools. What did they have to say to you overall about why more women don't go on to become CEOs?
Well, it was a really fascinating set of issues, and I think that their reluctant conclusion is there's a lot more bias, resistance, and sense of discomfort with women achieving that level of power than anyone wanted to think. And what a lot of people said to me was, look, okay, we understand that, you know, it takes a while to work your way to the top. Let's be patient. Let's work hard. Let's check all the boxes, do everything, fulfill all the requirements, and in time our numbers will swell. But here we are 40-plus years after women have entered the workforce and stayed in the workforce, and there's still a really paltry number who have become CEOs. And so they have concluded that it's really more systemic and more subtle than they wanted to believe. And some of the things that they cited were that It's an incredibly competitive universe, of course, and women are often perceived to be easier targets. Men, as one woman said to me, they play a 24/7 game of dodgeball, and you're getting hit in the head all the time, and they figure they can knock you out first, and then they'll knock out the guys. So the corporate politics are rough and tumble, and men are socialized and skilled in playing them in ways that some women haven't been socialized and trained to do. In addition, it's a very male world, and when you ascend past a certain level, you know, for a while you can get ahead by sort of doing your job really well and delivering the profits or whatever measure your company sets for you. But when it comes to the so-called C-suite from which a CEO will be chosen, there are a lot more intangible qualities. Who's a leader? Who's visionary? Who gets along well? Who do we see as ready? And men have had more difficulty seeing women as ready or accepting them into that world as peers on the whole than we thought.
I want to talk about that competitive aspect that you mentioned, that it can be pretty rough at the top where people are vying for that possible CEO slot. And you talked to some women who said women haven't really been socialized to fight for themselves. It doesn't always seem natural to women to get in there and advocate, sometimes get tough. What did you hear about that?
Yes, what I think is interesting is this is not to suggest that women can't be steely or assertive or highly competent or aggressive, but I think men are less embarrassed at promoting themselves, at saying, I did this, I own this, this is my accomplishment, and by the way, person A or B, you know, is nowhere as good as me. I think, again, there are generalities, there are exceptions, but on the whole, I think that, you know, to get ahead, you have to be very assertive about what you've accomplished. You have to be adept at corporate politics, and some women are, but a lot are less so. And you have to be unembarrassed about jockeying for position. This is the hard fact of life. But for women, often when they do those things, they're perceived as aggressive or bitchy or obnoxious or intolerable. You know, their displays of aggression, if they exert them, are also received more harshly, research has shown, than men.
That kind of gets at the idea of what a CEO is supposed to be like, at least what society thinks a CEO is supposed to be like. And it sounds as though some of these women who are vying for this top spot, people would say, oh, you know, that person is reliable or dependable, but they don't have, maybe they don't have gravitas, or they don't have
right. That
vision.
Well, the dean of the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern said to me, I used to like the term gravitas, but now I just think it's code for not like me, you know? And I think that I think that there are intangibles as to who is seen as visionary and bold and creative. And one of the women said to me, if she had to write a book about women in business, the title would be Dependable Backup. So I think there are those perception problems. And I do want to say, you know, not all women who make it, you know, or men should be seen as sort of vicious sharks, you know, in an ocean of blood. It's just that you have to be tough-minded and you have to be assertive and you have to be unembarrassed about saying, hey, I'm good at what I do, and here's proof. And that has culturally sometimes been challenging. But at the same time, you know, you need to be, your attributes need to be recognized by people, and it's been shown again and again that women are more likely to be overlooked. They're less likely to be seen as having that magic, special, intangible stuff.
You talked to one woman who said that to be seen as equal to the men that she was, her peers, she had to exceed them in the amount of money that she made. So did you get the sense that to compete, women actually had to outperform men, not just equal them, but outperform them?
I think that a number of the women I talked to did feel that way. And I think there's something that I found troubling, and a lot of the women I talked to found troubling, which is this sense that, you know, we still maybe have more discomfort with women exerting power, with women who are unapologetically interested in power and displaying ambition. They're not, they have a little more trouble being accepted and being seen as likable or as we discussed, you know, acceptable. So there's both the idea that you have to kind of prove yourself over and over again, possibly more than men do, and the problem that when you play the man's game, you're seen as a really horrible person that no one wants to work for or with.
Susan Cheer is with us right now, senior correspondent on gender issues for the New York Times, where she just wrote a piece called Why Women Aren't CEOs. And Susan, one comment that someone else made to you along the way, she said it's lonely. Is that a factor for women? Because there's not a big pool of peers for women when they're at these levels. How does that factor in?
I think it's very important. I talk to people who have done research. There's an interesting initiative being sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation, and one of the things they're doing is interviewing women who did become CEOs because they want to get a pool of experiences and advice that aspiring women can draw on just because they're so lonely. And there is a sense that you don't hear enough from other women who can tell you how to do it in whatever style works for you. And so I think the ranks get lonelier. You're an outlier. You're the exception. You're the only woman in the room. Look, you know, if you want to make it, you can deal with that. But it does mean you don't have a lot of comradeship, and you don't have the instant rapport that you might have that men have with each other.
Now, in terms of the phrase confidence gap, that's something we've been hearing for a while, that women might not be as ready to talk up their accomplishments. Is that something that you see women at these upper reaches of power? Is it still something they're susceptible to them, even when they're at the top, in the C-suite maybe, almost at that number one position?
I think that by the time they get to the C-suite, a lot of them are very confident. But a number of women said to me that earlier in their careers, they had to have men who believed in them persuade them to take on jobs because they'd say, oh, I'm not sure that I can do it. There was a great anecdote which, you know, is told around business circles of someone's giving a corporate presentation and they ask for an expert on breastfeeding to raise hands. And this man raises his hand based on the fact his wife was breastfeeding and he watched her. And none of the women in the audience, many of whom were mothers who had breastfed, raised their hands. I mean, they were the real experts.
Oh, boy.
So they didn't think they were. So, but I do think that, you know, when women get up higher, I heard a lot of very confident women that I spoke with, but a lot of them said it took them time to believe in themselves, maybe more time than their male peers took.
Now, Susan, this is something that you've been through yourself as someone who has been in the corporate world. Talking to all of the people that you did, hearing all this, did it put any pieces together for you about what needs to change?
Yes, I think there are a number of things that need to change. Yes, I have been a senior executive at the New York Times. I've had a wonderful career. I'm very lucky. I've experienced being the only woman in the room and the first woman in this and that. And so a lot of what I talked to them about certainly resonated. And it's very rewarding when you get there. But I think what needs to change is, one, women really need much more active encouragement and systemic encouragement in their companies. Promising women need to be identified and actively, you know, in business circles, they talk about the difference between having a sponsor and a mentor. A sponsor is someone who's got the power to make things happen for you. You need someone in the room where the decision-making is saying, you know what, that woman is great, and I am going to vouch for her. So, you know, women can't do it without men believing that it's important and helping them achieve it. They need more women to support them and to rely on a pool of their experience to help them. I think that it's, of course, clear that we need to understand the burdens that many women shoulder for family responsibilities and how to help the workplace be less about face time and more about measurable results that you deliver when you can, how you can. But, you know, a lot, it can't just be women. Men have to be active partners in seeing this as important and valuable and a source of strength. Because women sort of swimming against the tide on their own, that won't happen. I think the last 40 years suggests it's still such a hard road without more self-examination by men about why they might be resistant to this.
I want to get a caller on with us now. Julie is with us from Duluth, Minnesota. Julie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering about something in terms of the scope of the discussion here. taking it back a little more big picture, and I wonder to what extent it's been studied, if at all, whether women want this increasingly. And let me give you an example. I have a graduate degree, and I know plenty of women and have had friends who have graduate degrees, and very few of us that have said, I want to be a CEO someday. What I see happening instead is, I mean, certainly competent women going for other goals like starting their own company. Or, you know, my goal in life now, because I'm in my 50s and I'm certainly not going to climb any corporate ladder anymore, and I gave up on that idea long ago because of the how much you have to conform, and then, you know, nothing happens. So, you know, but instead I feel freer now to, because I just turned away from that, I feel freer to pursue a goal of freedom, basically, and being able to do what I want to do, not necessarily be rich, but I've chosen another way to be successful.
Julie, thank you so much for that call. And the basic question there, Susan, is do women want to be CEOs? A lot more context there, but what do you think?
Well, I think it's a very important question. The reason that I talked to number two women is that they passed that bar. They wanted to be. Those women wanted to be. Those women had decided to stick it out and try for that number one spot, and a lot of them still didn't make it. So I agree that there's a lot of attrition, and there's a lot of attrition for very good reasons. It's a brutal work life. There often isn't a lot of autonomy. There's a lot of barriers. There was a lot of family challenges, and a lot of women do choose entrepreneurship exactly for those reasons, and there's no doubt about that. But I tried to take that factor and say, let's look at the experiences of those women who decided that for whatever reason they wanted that goal.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Susan Chira is a senior correspondent on gender issues for the New York Times.
President Trump signed a bill yesterday that imposes sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea, but he did it grudgingly.
In a signing statement, the president agreed with punishing Russia and the other countries for what he called destabilizing behavior, but he said the legislation was, quote, significantly flawed.
Jordan Tama joins us now to look at what the most recent sanctions could mean. He's an associate professor at American University's School of International Service. Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
These sanctions were congressionally mandated, and the president wasn't happy with them. What was he objecting to?
Well, he wants to develop closer ties with the Russian government, and he wants to retain the freedom to be able to lift sanctions on Russia as a means of fostering a more cooperative relationship with Russia. And there's a basic policy disagreement here between Trump and Congress. Congress sees this differently. Congress, this includes Republicans and Democrats in Congress, believe that the United States needs to take a tough stance toward Russia in response to a variety of things that Russia has done that have generated strong concern in the U.S., most recently, and especially the hacking of U.S. email accounts that was designed to influence the 2016 presidential election, but also other aspects of Russian foreign policy, its invasion of Ukraine, intervention in Syria to prop up an ally of its, Bashar al-Assad, who's a dictator. And Congress wants to maintain and even intensify sanctions on Russia as a result of that.
And basically, Congress is saying to the president, we are taking the power away from you to loosen sanctions, basically on your own decision. That has to come back to us. Is this an unusual move for Congress to take?
It is partly unusual. So Congress has acted in many cases in the past to impose sanctions on other countries, even when the president has not wanted to take that step. And this has been true of all our recent presidents. There have been cases where Congress wanted to take a tougher stance toward some other countries than the president wanted to take. But what's unusual here is what you point out, the idea that Congress would have essentially a veto over the potential lifting of sanctions by Trump on Russia. So the law here stipulates that if Trump wants to lift sanctions on Russia, Congress can review that, and the sanctions can't actually be lifted for a certain period of time while Congress reviews it, and Congress could essentially overturn Trump's decision to lift sanctions, and that's new.
And just to be clear, this is obviously affecting President Trump right now, but if these sanctions were still in place when there's a new president, they would also apply to that person as well.
That's correct.
And so this is basically pretty publicly saying to the world, Congress is taking some power away from the president in deciding on the strictness of sanctions that, of course, are part and parcel of foreign relations and diplomacy and gives and takes. What kind of message might that be sending to the rest of the world and to other leaders?
Well, it certainly sends a message that the U.S. government is not unified on this issue. I think to many foreign leaders, it sends a positive message, the congressional action, in the sense that there are foreign leaders that want the United States to maintain a tough stance toward Russia. We have European allies that themselves feel threatened by various things that Russia has been doing, and so they are heartened by Congress stepping in here and passing a law that ensures that the U.S. will still have a tough stance toward Russia in the sanctions area. It to the Russian government sends a negative message because they would like to have these sanctions lifted. So the Russian government is very disappointed, to put it mildly, that this law has been passed. But I think that it's very appropriate and necessary for the U.S. to respond strongly to Russian actions, especially the interference by Russia in the presidential election, which is something that's really a threat to American democracy. And our leaders need to take action to do what they can to show that we're not going to allow other countries to interfere in our elections, and we'll try to hold other countries accountable if they do try to do that.
Well, and you referenced the Russian leadership, and in a Facebook post, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said, quote, "The U.S. establishment fully outwitted Trump. The president is not happy about the new sanctions, yet he could not but sign the bill," end quote. Fully outwitted isn't the most flattering language to use in talking about President Trump.
Right. Well, Russian leaders are certainly, feeling upset because they expected that Trump would come in and be able to pursue a pro-Russia policy, including the lifting of sanctions, which is a top priority for them. And they have now found that this is not going to happen because of Congress stepping in. And so, there's an irony here in that you had a new president elected who got elected with a platform. He had talked repeatedly during the presidential campaign about wanting to improve relations with Russia. Everyone assumed he was going to lift sanctions on Russia. And yet now we're at a point where U.S.-Russian relations are, in very poor condition. Congress, though, I think is doing the right thing by passing this law.
Jordan Tama is an associate professor at American University's School of International Service. We're talking about the new bill that outlines sanctions against North Korea, Iran, and Russia. And Jordan, let's get into the nuts and bolts. What are these specific sanctions against those countries?
Sure. Well, there's a whole slew of them involving three countries, as you mentioned, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Mainly are sanctions that limit a variety of kinds of economic transactions with those countries, and also in some cases target individuals in those countries who are known to have committed certain kinds of egregious violations of human rights or been involved in other kinds of egregious policies. So there's a range of sanctions on Russia, for example, just to take the Russia piece,
sure.
Some of which had been passed by Congress previously or been imposed by President Obama by executive order. And one of the things this law does is it codifies all those, and it says these are all these sanctions, even ones that previously had just been issued by executive order now have the force of U.S. law, and the president cannot lift these sanctions without, you know, this congressional review process being triggered. And those range from sanctions on individual officials in Russia that have committed human rights violations. Those people are not allowed to travel to the United States, and if they have financial assets in the United States, those assets are frozen. They include sanctions on other Russian institutions that were put in place following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Those include some sanctions on certain economic sectors in Russia, and then there's a whole slew of others on Iran and North Korea. So it's a long list.
And in just about the 30 seconds we have left, Jordan, other presidents have released signing statements when they've signed onto bills that they don't agree with. That is how President Trump expressed his disapproval of this. Was there anything surprising that he did a signing statement or in the content of it?
Well, yes, many presidents have issued signing statements before, and that includes signing statements regarding sanctions laws. There have been a number of sanctions laws and laws passed in the past that presidents have issued signing statements regarding. What's different here, in part, is the tone. Trump had a bit of a condescending tone toward Congress in his signing statement. He was really criticizing Congress for, he says, passing this legislation in haste. He says he expects the Congress to refrain from using this flawed bill to hinder our important work with European allies, et cetera. And that's a bit more of a, it's a hostile tone toward Congress than past signing statements have had.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be on the program.
That was Jordan Tama, Associate Professor at American University's School of International Service. He joined us to talk about the bill that President Trump signed into law yesterday that levies sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea. July 31st was Black Women's Equal Pay Day for 2017. That marks how long into this year that African-American women had to work to make the same amount as their white male counterparts did last year.
Janelle Jones joins us now. She's an economic analyst for the Economic Policy Institute. Janelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could we start by finding out just how big the pay gap is between Black women and their white male counterparts?
Sure. So Black Women's Equal Pay Day is, you know, I don't want to say celebrate because it's really nothing to celebrate, but it marks the day of how long it takes Black women to catch up to what white men earned last year. And right now that pay gap is about 67 cents on the dollar. So every dollar, you know, this adds up over a day, over a week, over a lifetime of working that Black women are being underpaid.
And it's, what, 7 months into the year for Black women to catch up with white men?
Right. So it's been months. We've had, you know, Valentine's Day, we've had Easter, we've had Mother's Day, we've had July 4th. And all of this time into the year, Black women still are just now catching up with what white men earned last year.
We're going to get into some of the details, but in broad strokes, why does this wage gap exist for Black women?
Right. So one of the things that we've seen is that the discrimination faced by Black women is, you know, special in that it's gender and race-based. So we know that there's a gender wage gap between white men and white women, and we know that there's also a racial wage gap between all white workers and all Black workers. And the thing that puts Black women in this intersection is seen in their low wages, and we see that the gap is even larger for Black women who face this kind of double discrimination.
It's really interesting. In your piece, you write about how the gap between Black women and other workers, it actually used to be smaller decades ago. Now it's bigger again. So it sounds like things are actually moving backwards.
Right. Well, one of the things that we've seen for all kind of middle wage workers is a slowing of wage growth. Something that we talk about all the time at EPI is wage stagnation. So we see that wages aren't growing for people at the middle and the bottom. And Black workers are, you know, more concentrated in the middle and the bottom. So they're definitely facing this.
I want to talk about some of the myths that you're out to address. One of them is that if Black women worked harder, they'd get the pay that they deserve. What does the data say there?
So the data shows that since 1979, Black women have actually increased their hours of work more than white men and more than white women even. And we're seeing that this is particularly strong among low-wage workers. So workers at like the bottom 20, bottom 40% of the wage distribution have actually increased their annual hours by like 20%. So it's not that they're not working. It's just that they're being underpaid. And Black women in particular have always had, you know, very strong labor force participation rates. They've always been very connected to the labor market. So it's not a lack of, you know, not going to work or not having employment. It's really just a matter of low wages.
And African-American with children are also working especially hard, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah. African-American mothers, you know, they've always been very connected to the labor market. The data that we have analyzed shows that African-American mothers have actually increased their work hours more than African-American women without children.
It's interesting, too, a statistic from your piece that in 2015, married black women with children worked over 200 hours more per year than married white or Hispanic women with children. What does a figure like that tell you?
Right. So this is telling me that, you know, in some relationships, for some people, marriage is kind of like it gives you an option of whether or not you want to work because you have a partner who's bringing in those wages. But for black women who are married, we're seeing that this isn't an option. They're still working as if they were single. So it says something about kind of household income for black married couples, but it shows that black women, you know, regardless of family structure, they're always connected to the workforce. They're usually employed. They're usually working longer hours than their white or Hispanic counterparts.
And let's look at another one of the myths you say you want to bust, that black women can educate themselves out of the pay gap, maybe get that advanced degree, college degree, or a master's or a PhD. Does that work?
We have found that it has not. And this is actually like maybe one of the first or second criticisms that we get all the time when we talk about the black women's pay gap. It's just that, you know, they're not going to school. They go to high school and then that's it. They don't go to college. They don't get advanced degrees. And that is just simply not true. So this is actually one of our favorite things to do, is to break this down by educational attainment. And it shows that black women with an advanced degree, you know, a master's degree, a doctorate, a lawyer, they're actually making less than white men who just have a bachelor's degree. And this is $7 an hour, which is, I mean, this is real money after weeks and months and years in the labor market. This really makes a difference for black women who are doing what they're supposed to do or what society tells them to do, which is to keep getting education.
Right. You say that the largest gap, actually, of nearly $17 an hour occurs for workers with more than a college degree.
Right. And this is so shocking to me, because you would think that it's sending such a strong signal. You have a white man and a black woman who both have master's degrees, who both have JDs, who are both medical doctors, and you're still seeing a large, large gap in wages.
We're talking with Janelle Jones right now, an economic analyst for the Economic Policy Institute, talking about the pay gap that persists and has been growing for black women in the United States. And Janelle, another issue you want to address here is that the wage gap, this is another myth that you look at, the wage gap is the result of black women choosing careers that pay less.
Right. So this is the other thing that we hear all of the time, is that, okay, sure, they're working, they have jobs, they went to school, but they're just not choosing the right jobs. They're choosing jobs that, you know, don't pay great wages. And this is why, on average, they make less than white men. Well, that is also not true. In almost every occupation, black women earn less than white men. And we look at, in the piece, we look at a bunch of different occupations, some that, you know, are traditionally low paid, such as retail salesperson or customer service workers. But we also look at accountants and lawyers and physicians, and we see that there's still a pay gap between black women and white men. So it's not that they're choosing the wrong jobs. It's that there's discrimination, both gender and racial, within occupations.
Well, and I imagine also there's still higher institutional hurdles for black women to get into some of those more male-dominated fields.
Right. So something that we don't really touch on that much in the piece is there's also discrimination in terms of being promoted and getting mentoring in occupations. So all of these things kind of play into what your wages eventually will be. And we see that black women are kind of facing these hurdles and obstacles at each and every step.
Now, this is an important story. Do you feel that it was covered enough, that this gets enough attention? We hear a lot more than we used to about the pay gap for women in general, but do you think there's enough awareness about the pay gap for African-American women?
I mean, I think that we keep marking the day because we don't think that it's talked enough about all year long. And even on the day of, I mean, I think it definitely got played with audiences who, you know, care about these issues and care about working women and care about African-American women in particular. But I don't think that it gets the attention that it should. I mean, this is, you know, millions of people who are underpaid simply based on their race and their gender. And something that EPI is committed to is continuing to document just how big this gap is, how long it's been going on, and where it's occurring, which is basically all over the labor market.
With all that in mind, what do you think needs to change? What do you recommend to start to close that wage gap for Black women?
So one thing, you know, Economic Policy Institute being kind of a very progressive think tank, is we talk about the role of unions. And when you give workers the option to collectively bargain, you take away a lot of the ability of employers to discriminate based on race and gender. And there's actually, you know, evidence and data that supports this that shows that Black workers, Black men and Black women in unions make more than their counterparts who are not in unions. So being able to collectively bargain is so important to wages for Black workers. Another thing we mention in the piece is raising the federal minimum wage. When you talk about Black women workers, they're so overrepresented among low-wage workers that if you do something to kind of lift the wages of people at the bottom, you're going to have an impact on Black women's wages. There's absolutely no way you couldn't, because there's so many that are in low-paid work.
Now, going back to unions in Wisconsin, unions are in a kind of a precipitous decline right now, and that's being echoed in lots of other places around the country. Do you see that now as another hurdle for closing this wage gap for Black women?
Right. This is something I think about all the time. I'm actually from Northeast Ohio, so a lot of my family are UAW members who work in manufacturing, and it's been a real boost to kind of their economic security and what they've been able to accomplish. But, yeah, I mean, we've seen over the past, you know, several decades, the decline in unions has had this very negative impact on wages and benefits, as a matter of fact, for Black workers. So I think it's something that we definitely should keep talking about. We should keep putting more energy to, and we should keep trying to energize, because it really does make a difference for all workers and particularly for Black workers.
Taking into account the current political climate and some of the issues we just discussed, how optimistic are you that there could be change on this in the positive direction sometime soon?
That is a good question. We are based in D.C., so it is hard to be continuously optimistic. But there are spots where we think, you know, things could happen, particularly at the state level. Like, we are seeing states increasing their minimum wage, passing fair scheduling laws, passing paid sick days. So while I am more pessimistic about things happening at the federal level, I think there are a lot of ways that the local and state level, there could be some real movement on this. One thing that always brightens my day is following up on the Fight for 15, which is, you know, this multiracial, multi-state movement that is really about increasing worker power. It's about unions. It's about wages. And it's so inclusive, and it's making a real impact.
Janelle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Janelle Jones, economic policy analyst for the Economic Policy Institute, joining us to talk about how Black women had to work 7 extra months to make the same amount as their white male counterparts did last year.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll dig into President Trump's plans for improving the nation's infrastructure and whether privatization of some assets makes sense.
It's fair season, and we'll talk with the author of a new cookbook that highlights some of the foods that fairgoers love to eat.
That's tomorrow on Central Time.